Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
And welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, May 23rd, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll highlight dispatches on the worsening impact of the already challenging humanitarian crisis in the Gaza region of Palestine amid the declaration of a ceasefire with the Israeli regime. Ethiopians have held a rally demanding the halt to foreign interference by Western states in the internal affairs of the country. A leading civilian member of the Sovereign Sudan Council has resigned following further deaths of protesters at the hands of the security forces. And an assessment is underway after the eruption of a volcano in the eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the second hour, we further examine issues related to the current situation in Africa and the international community. Later, we hear excerpts from a briefing by the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention related to the status of COVID-19 infections and the rollout of vaccination programs on the continent. Finally, we pay tribute to Africa Liberation Day, the 58th anniversary of the formation of the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, the predecessor to the African Union. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
فكروني كلموني تاني عنك غروني محو نار الشوق الشوق في قلبي وفي عيوني كلموني تاني عنك صحوا النار الشوق الشوق في قلبي وفي عيوني كلموني تاني تاني عنك فكروني فكروني كلموني تاني عنك فكروني صحوا نار الشوق الشوق في قلبي وفي عيوني رجعوا للماضي بنعيم وغناوته وبحلاوته وبعذابه وبقساوته رجعوا
Thank you. I'm Thank you.
من ايديك الأيام قليلة.
Husband
حياة أيام قليلة. ليه نضيع عمرنا أجري وخضام؟
ننسى كل أسى يلا للحق.
انت للي
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Evacuations underway as homes burn after volcanic eruption in DRC's Goma City. Investigations in northwest China after 21 people die in extreme weather in ultramarathon events. And in Gaza, government offices are reopening after an Israeli-Palestinian ceasefire deal but health infrastructure left in ruins. Hello and thank you for joining us on Africa Live. I am Penina Karibe. Let's have a look at the stories coming up this hour. Owner of the Ever Given blames Suez Canal Authority for the grounding of the ship. In sports, the story of a boxer who has set up a centre for the reintegration of children and unemployed youth. Let's begin in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where thousands of residents of the eastern city of Goma have been fleeing their homes after Mount Nyiragongo erupted on Saturday. Many of them crossed into Rwanda after Kigali opened the border point of Gisenyi. Authorities in Rwanda say over 3,500 have so far arrived and are being housed in local schools and places of worship. A volcanologist in Goma said new fractures were opening in the volcano, letting lava flow south toward the city after initially flowing east towards Rwanda. Molten lava set homes on fire as it slowly spread to the lakeside city of about 2 million. Local reports say the lava seems to be slowing down after reaching the city's suburbs. Some residents had tried using water to stop it before fleeing. Nyiragongo last erupted in 2002 and left at least 250 people dead and 150,000 displaced. It is also considered among the most dangerous volcanoes in the world. A special investigation is being carried out in northwest China into the deaths of 21 ultra-marathon runners. They died as extreme weather hit the race, which covers a distance of 100 kilometers in mountainous terrain. Local authorities said the runners had to contend with hailstones, freezing rain and gale-force winds in one high-altitude section. A significant temperature drop caused multiple cases of hypothermia. Another 151 runners were confirmed safe. Eight of them had minor injuries. Here's what local authorities had to say.
This was a public safety incident caused by a sudden weather change. Authorities in Gansu province have set up an investigation team to further look into the incident. As the organizers of the marathon race, we feel a deep sense of guilt and responsibility. We express our deep condolences to the victims and our deep sympathy to the bereaved families and those who were injured.
Two people have been killed and eight others injured in a shooting incident in the U.S. state of Minnesota. Police in the city of Minneapolis say they found a very chaotic scene with multiple people shot laying on the ground. Initial investigations indicate two people shot at each other as they got into a verbal confrontation. One of the shooters was killed and the other has been taken into custody. Meanwhile, in Gaza, government offices are reopening following a ceasefire deal which ended 11 days of fighting between Israel and Palestinian militants. The narrow strip was left devastated by the conflict, with much of its health infrastructure in ruins. Our correspondent Noor Harazin has more.
The El Rimal Health Center and the administrative building of the Gaza Health Ministry are some of the structures severely damaged by Israeli airstrikes. Authorities say some doctors and officers in the building were also injured. The Arimal Center is the only COVID-19 testing facility in Gaza.
Our work stopped due to the bombings and power cuts. They've affected our equipment. This is the only lab under the Gaza Health Ministry that specializes in coronavirus testing. Now it's impossible to complete these tests, which will trigger a spread of the virus. You can see the destruction around me from the bombing.
The COVID-19 situation has worsened in recent weeks, causing a major strain on the Palestinian healthcare system. Gaza officials have warned of a disaster due to the damages and lack of medical equipment. They say the matter has been worsened by evacuations during Israel's assault. Thousands of families took shelter in schools run by the United Nations. Classrooms are overcrowded, sparking concerns over a rapid rise in COVID-19 cases.
I live here in one room with my children and grandchildren. The men sleep outside to lessen the crowd. We can't even get tested. I can't sleep or even breathe at night because I'm afraid we'll all get sick.
As you can see, we are overcrowded here. There are 40 to 50 people per room. This does not provide any protection from disease. Health tools and protective equipment are not available.
Apart from masks, gloves, and basic cleaning items, medical supplies are also running low. Although Egypt has let in a few trucks with some humanitarian aid, Gaza's healthcare sector is still on edge over shortages. Nur Harazin, CGTN, Gaza.
The United Nations Security Council has called on all sides in the Israel-Palestinian conflict to fully adhere to the terms of the ceasefire. The 15-member council issued a statement on Saturday, having been unable to speak during the 11-day conflict due to opposition by the United States. It stressed the immediate need for humanitarian aid for Palestinian civilians. The French mission to the United Nations said it suspended its push for a resolution on the issue. Now, amid the ceasefire between Israel and Palestinians brokered by Egypt, many Palestinians are still in dire need of humanitarian assistance. The Egyptian government is now offering much-needed supplies to the affected Palestinians. Meanwhile, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has announced that Egypt will help in Gaza's reconstruction efforts through projects worth $500 million. Here's CGTN's Adel Mahri with more details.
The suffering of the people in Gaza during the heavy Israeli bombardment has led to lots of public sympathy for them across Egypt. That has fueled the strongest public awakening in the support of the Palestinian cause seen in years. A stream of in-kind donations crossed the border to assist the people besieged in the Gaza Strip.
It is not allowed in Egypt to organize protests, even if it's in support of a foreign cause. The unions know that any request to organize protests will be rejected. Any violation of that will see the Egyptian administration arrest those involved. So the least Egyptians could do at this stage is to volunteer and show support to Palestine through donations. It is the only way they can show solidarity.
The Egyptian authorities have opened the Rafah Passage, Gaza's only gateway to the world. It's allowing trucks carrying tons of supplies into the strip. The Egyptian Red Crescent was the first to offer post-war trauma support.
One of the most important services we provide is primary psychological support. Some people were harmed, others lost their loved ones, others are in critical condition. The Egyptian Red Crescent is very strong in primary psychological support. We are also currently in contact with the Palestinian side to determine the needs of the camps or shelters for those displaced by the bombings.
A ceasefire is in place, but that doesn't mean the assistance from Egypt will stop. With the cessation of hostilities, talks about reconstruction have begun. Despite Egypt's challenged economy, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has vowed to build infrastructure and construction projects in Gaza worth $500 million.
The magnitude of destruction Gaza witnessed in just 1 week by far exceeds any previous wars between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And that has created a driving force for Egyptians to show their Palestinian brothers that they can support them by any means to at least live the suffrage they feel. Adel Mahoui, CGTN, Cairo.
The violence in Gaza is posing a dilemma for Arab countries that recently restored ties with Israel. United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco and Sudan, which all recently normalized ties with Israel, now find themselves balancing their new relationship against citizens who have been vocal in their anger at Israel's violence. Meanwhile, Egypt is seeking to restore its regional clout in this conflict. Here's Yasser Hakim with more details.
With the first major crisis in Palestine since the normalization of ties with Israel, reaction from countries like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have been described as comparatively muted.
Unfortunately, the reaction from these countries was not up to the horrific events on the ground. It was limited to denouncing or condemning only. As observers, we expected these countries to take steps such as freezing the normalization process or taking tough diplomatic action. It's obvious these countries have internal problems. Sudan, for example, is going through a transitional process. Morocco, the UAE, and Bahrain have their own issues, but this goes for many Arab states.
Normalization doesn't bode well with the anger amongst citizens in the region against Israel's military strikes on Palestinian civilians.
There is a large stream of anger in the Arab world against what the Israelis are doing against the Palestinians. And it's normal that our people everywhere are angry with the process where we give Israel some privileges without having any return for this. But we have to come to a sort of national consensus. What are our next step with Israel? There are two ways, either to start or to continue hatred against the Israelis, or to convince the Israeli people and the Israeli leadership that peace would bring to Israel much more benefit rather than war and aggression.
Meanwhile, there were questions concerning Egypt's position in the Arab world after the Arab-Israeli closeness.
While some have expected that Egypt's role in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict would diminish, Cairo has actually managed to spearhead efforts that led to a ceasefire between both sides.
Experts believe it's been a testing period for Cairo as well.
In all the clashes between Israel and Palestinian resistance or in Gaza, Egypt was a major player. In 2014, in 2008, and during the Intifada, Egypt was a main and influential player between the sides. And the same now, in 2021, Egypt had the leading role, although Jordan and Qatar were involved as well.
Although the Abraham Normalization Accords have softened the Arab stance towards Israel, it has also cemented Egypt's presence as an influential force in a changing geopolitical Middle East. Yes, Hakim, for CGTN, Cairo.
Let's wake up our top story at this hour, and we began in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where thousands of residents of the eastern city of Goma have been fleeing their homes after Mount Nyiragongo erupted on Saturday. Many of them crossed into Rwanda after Kigali opened the border point of Gisenyi. Authorities in Rwanda say over 3,500 have so far arrived and are being housed in local schools and places of worship. Let's now go live to the DRC. We have our correspondent Chris Ochamringa joining us from Kinshasa for more on this. Chris, what is the latest on this volcanic eruption in Goma?
Well, Penina, Goma city is now relatively calm because the lava from Mount Nyiragongo has stopped flowing. The officials there say there were no deaths or casualties reported, and they've urged the people to remain calm. But like you mentioned, many people, many residents of Goma City fled to neighboring towns and some even crossed to Rwanda. They are fearing for their lives because they still have very fresh memories of what happened in 2002 when the volcano erupted, killing more than 200 people, and it also destroyed very many houses. We've also seen some footage of roads that were destroyed and also some houses in valleys on the outskirts of Goma that were also destroyed. The governor of that area, a military governor, says that they are working with the authorities in the central government in Kinshasa to come up with strategies of trying to help the local people there.
Okay, so Chris, you've touched a little about the damage done. So let's talk a bit more on that. You know, just paint us a picture of the kind of damage we're looking at and how those who are living near Mount Nyiragongo in Goma are being assisted.
Well, Well, Penina, I spoke to some people in Goma City, and they told me that there were many houses that were destroyed. We don't know yet the exact extent of the damage because the government hasn't given any official information. We hope that they will make that announcement later today. But we've just seen footage, like I mentioned earlier, of houses, you know, in valleys that were burnt by the lava that flowed from Mount Nyiragongo. The experts there say that Goma City, which has an estimated population of 2 million people, was out of danger because the lava was flowing towards the Rwandan border. And so right now we are still waiting for officials to give us an update. We also know that the Prime Minister of the DRC, Sama Lukonde, held a meeting with other cabinet ministers, and they decided to come up with an evacuation plan for the people in Goma. The DRC President, Felix Tshisekedi, who had visited Europe, had to cut short his visit to return to oversee this humanitarian response because the area where this volcano erupted is under a state of siege, and so there's a restriction of movement of people to different areas. But then, you know, because it was an emergency, people had to just go to run for their lives. We're waiting to hear more from the government authorities. Penina?
All right, Chris, we appreciate that update. Thank you very much for joining us. Chris Chamringa, live in Kinshasa. Now, some COVID-19 patients in India are suffering from a potentially deadly black fungus infection. Local media say over 7,200 cases of black fungus have been found across the country. The disease, which is called mucormycosis, has a high mortality rate, is affecting increasing numbers of India's coronavirus patients. It can cause blurred or double vision, chest pain and breathing difficulties. And doctors have often been removing an eye or part of the jaw to try to stop its spread. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said the country had to take precaution and prepare to deal with it. Now, earlier we talked to Dr. Alice Hyun-Kyung Tan, an internist at Ms. Medi Women's Hospital in Seoul, and she explained more about the black fungus disease in India, the medical term for which is mucormycosis, and how it's linked to COVID-19. Take a listen.
So mucormycosis is a very rare but very dangerous disease with a high mortality of about 50%. The range is between 40 and 80% depending on the location of infection and the underlying condition of the patient. The fungus can infect any part of the body, but the face is frequently infected, and it can infect the eyes, nose, and sinuses. And once it affects the soft tissue and skin, it can start to eat away and destroy the bone. And from the bone, it can start to infect the brain. It's a very difficult disease to diagnose, and oftentimes patients will have progressed for several days before coming to a doctor to get the diagnosis. The relationship between mucormycosis and COVID-19 is as yet unknown. However, there are many risk factors involved. First of all, diabetes is a well-known risk factor for mucormycosis, and up to 10% of adults in India have diabetes. It's thought that many more adults have undiagnosed diabetes. COVID-19 also, as a disease, causes irregularities in the immune system. It can also cause blood sugars to get out of control. So it's really a perfect storm in terms of both the disease and the treatment of the disease. They can all lead to a high risk for mucormycosis.
Namibia is pushing ahead with its COVID-19 vaccination drive to meet the 60% target for herd immunity. The country's Vice President, Nangolo Mbumba, says it's in a bid to lower the country's infection rate as well as reduce the number of hospitalized persons. The Vice President is among the first to receive a dose of the Sinopharm jab. The vaccines are a donation from the Chinese government. Mbumba is encouraging everyone to get vaccinated to help curb the spread of the virus. Coming up to 19 minutes into the hour, you're watching Africa Live. Let's take a short break. Coming up. Why Africa leads the world in road traffic deaths every year and what the continent can do about it.
Africa is a continent of diversity, with varied climates and enchanting geography, and a people so distinct, but with a shared enduring spirit. We are at the heart of the continent, to bring you the untold stories.
Let's have a look.
We celebrate Africa as it shapes its own destiny.
I've been sure she's tuning in Cairo,
Syria,
Juba,
Johannesburg,
Ethiopia,
Tanzania.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
Nigeria is my home. 160 million vibrant, ambitious individuals constantly seeking the perfect self-expression. It is these people who inspired me to be that person that is seen, to be a voice that is heard, and ultimately to be the anchor that I am. I have to tap in, tune in, and turn on the very best qualities within me to deliver the news. I'm Richard Nta, an anchor for CGTN.
New details are emerging on the death of a black motorist 2 years ago after being stopped by police in the southern U.S. state of Louisiana. Video from cameras won by state police showed the arrest of Ronald Green. Police initially said he died during a car crash, but the videos show he died after being beaten by officers. CGTN's Toby Mews has the details, but a warning, some may find these images disturbing.
Okay, I'm sorry.
More video has been released of a controversial 2019 police arrest of a motorist following a police chase in the U.S. state of Louisiana. The driver, a 49-year-old black man, would later die, casting doubt on the police version of what exactly happened. The family of Ronald Green says that initially authorities told them that he had died from injuries from a car crash after a traffic violation 2 years ago in the city of Monroe.
A cover-up from the very beginning, from the top down. It's organized crime within the state of Louisiana.
The new videos come from the body cams of the four police officers, all white. They show Green being removed from his car by police and a scuffle on the ground. Green is face down while one officer is on top of him. Green is tased by another officer as they order him to put his hands behind his back. Once handcuffed, he's left face down. The AP reports that police officers are trained to roll detainees on their side or sit them up when handcuffed to ensure they are able to breathe. At one point, a police officer orders Green to lie on his stomach.
Don't you turn over.
All right.
Don't you turn over. You lay on your belly. Lay on your belly.
Green would later die on his way to the hospital. Green's family has launched a lawsuit and called his death a murder at the hands of the police. The FBI is conducting a civil rights investigation. The released videos come days before the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd, whose killing at the hands of a police officer led to months of protests across the U.S. and the world. Toby Mews reporting for CGTN, Arlington, Virginia.
The last 7 days have seen the world observe the 6th United Nations Global Safety Week. Every year, more than 1.3 million people die in road traffic crashes and 50 million are injured. One person dies every 24 seconds because of a crash. The World Health Organization says Africa is the region with the highest number of road traffic fatalities in the world. UN agencies are urging policymakers to lower speed limits in a bid to cut traffic deaths and injuries. A campaign to get people to slow down on the roads was launched this week. The UN says car crash injuries are the 8th leading cause of death globally for all age groups. It is also the number one leading cause of death among children and young adults between the ages of 5 and 29. The focus of this year's Global Road Safety Week is to encourage policymakers to drop speed limits to 30 kilometers an hour in cities where cyclists and pedestrians interact closely with car traffic. For more on this, we are now joined live by a World Health Organization Technical Officer, Binta Sacko, speaking to us via Zoom from Ouagadougou. Thank you very much for your time today, Binta. So the road fatalities in Africa clearly are worrying. The World Health Organization is recommending a speed of 30 kilometers an hour in major cities. Is this practical and how will it help the situation?
Thank you. Thank you for raising this issue. Indeed,
road fatalities are of concern in the region, and WHO is recommending a reduction of the speed limits in cities where pedestrian, cyclists, and motor traffic are mixing. And many countries have already successfully implemented this policy, and evidence shows that it does indeed reduce fatalities. That's why WHO is promoting this new policy, these new speed limits, from the standard 50 kilometers per hour to 30, because it's, like I was saying, you know, it's effective, and countries who have implemented it have seen a reduction in their fatality rates. And we know that for every kilometer increase in speed, we have about 4 to 5% increase in fatalities. So evidence does recommend that we have this shift in reduction of speed.
Okay, so most cities already have traffic clogs that make it impossible to even reach that speed. So what are the other factors causing these huge fatalities besides speed?
Yeah, and speed is just one amongst other risk factors. We also have drink driving, which is a very important risk factor increasing the risk of accidents. But we also have other behavioral risk factors, wearing seat belts, cyclists and motorcyclists having helmets, the child restraints for children, which may not reduce the risk of the accident, but definitely reduces the severity and the death that will occur when a crash happens. And, you know, apart from these behavioral risk factors, we also have risk factors that are related to the infrastructure, the road design, and also those that are related to the quality of the vehicle that are circulating in our, you know, on our roads, and the post-crash care. All these, you know, policies and recommendations on those risk factors are not fully implemented in the region, which makes it more dangerous on our streets. Once there's a crash, there's more likely a death that occurs.
Right. I like the fact that you've talked about the motorcyclists, for instance, especially here in Africa. That's a huge problem when it comes to just observing the basic safety measures that are needed to be on the road. So how best can nations handle those other contributors to traffic deaths, like drunkenness, pedestrian mistakes, and many others?
Well, the policies, the recommendations, WHO has a set of recommendations for all the risk factors. There are standards, international standards, that need to be adhered to. So I think what nations need to do now is implement these policies. But during driving, we know that by reducing the acceptable level of blood alcohol in drivers is a way to go. Not all countries, you know, meet the best practices in all these different policies. So it's now time for nations to mobilize their resources, put in, you know, the highest political will, and implement these recommendations for all the risk factors, not only for speed, but for all the other risk factors as well.
All right. Binta Sacco in Ouagadougou, many thanks for joining us. Tunisian President Kais Saied has met Italian Interior Minister and the European Commissioner for Home Affairs to discuss the irregular migration issue from Tunis. Adnan Shawashi has the details of that visit.
President Kais Saied urged European officials to adopt a comprehensive approach to irregular migration that goes beyond security solutions and addresses the root cause of this phenomenon. The Tunisian head of state emphasized the importance of combating poverty and unemployment and promoting development policies.
Unlike in the past, now we all need to look for a new way of tackling irregular migration. It's useless to treat the consequences without understanding the cause of this phenomenon. The main reasons are certainly linked to social and economic situation. Irregular migration from Tunisia was non-existent some 20 years ago, or very limited. The visa to Europe was not even required.
EU Commissioner for Home Affairs noted that most irregular arrivals from Tunisia will not be eligible to stay in Europe. In fact, irregular migrants will be given a return decision. Ylva Johansson added that this agreement will destroy the business model of the smugglers.
But it's equally important to also prevent irregular departures
to manage migration, to border management, to fight these organized criminal groups that are arranging and making a huge lot of money of putting people convincing people to get into these boats on very dangerous journeys. We have to fight the smugglers and prevent irregular departures.
Italy's interior minister announced that Tunisian authorities are willing to repatriate thousands of irregular migrants who have reached Lampedusa after departing from the Tunisian coast.
Tunisia has welcomed Italy's proposal to establish a direct hotline between our two countries to contain and block these irregular departures.
Tunisian Navy units rescued Bangladeshi and African undocumented migrants this week. Meanwhile, Coast Guard units in Sfax and Mehdiya thwarted several illegal sea border crossing attempts. At least 55 illegal migrants were arrested and 5 fishing vessels were seized.
The EU Commissioner for Home Affairs and Italian Interior Minister declared that the stability of Tunisia and the post-pandemic economic recovery are necessary for stability in Italy and the EU. Europe is committed to supporting Tunisia by contributing to development and to job creation in order to reduce irregular migration. Adnan Shawishi, CGTN, Tunis.
Saturday was the International Day for Biological Diversity. In Kenya, biodiversity levels are dropping by the year as habitat loss, climate change and human activity drive species to extinction. And as CGTN's Daniel Arap Moy reports, restoring mangroves in the coastal town of Lamu has never been more important.
Mangrove forests are important ecosystems that grow along Kenya's coastlines. In the country's coastal town of Lamu, they serve as habitats for fish, crabs and other marine species. Farmer Shukri, a resident of the island, has been spearheading the planting of mangroves at the coast.
The more we plant mangroves, the more the fishing grounds will be many. At the same time, the erosion will stop and also the number of crabs and also the juveniles, baby turtles, they are just living next to mangroves.
Here in Lamu, mangroves are also used to protect vulnerable coastal communities from the devastating impacts of climate change.
This mangrove forest is naturally protecting families and reducing the risk of tsunamis and other hazards in the coastal areas of Kenya.
But despite their wide-ranging benefits, mangroves are still being destroyed and degraded at an alarming rate. However, residents like Abdulhai Sultan understand the importance of the ecosystem.
Mangrove is very important for the whole Lamu. Like all the houses with the Makuti's roof, you must use the mangroves. That's very important for us. Mangrove is where the crab, they grow up, where the prawns, they grow up, where the jumbo, they grow up from the mangroves.
People are really polluting the environment in terms of the environmental degradation. People are cutting down mangroves and they don't replant them. People are pouring the plastic into the sea waters. And also people are doing unnecessary things with the environment. And this leads to many impacts, negative impacts.
For many residents here in Lamu, mangroves remain an important ecosystem that protects the environment. Daniel Arap Moy, CGTN, Lamu, Kenya.
Over in Zambia, environmental activist Robert Chimambo has been sharing his thoughts about conservation of biodiversity for our planet. He speaks about the need to protect the planet, especially during the coronavirus pandemic. He says the pandemic is a clear indicator of consequences that could face mankind if further degradation of the environment is not combated.
Coronavirus is a very good case. It is essentially our degradation of who? Our biodiversity, our environment, that these zoonotic diseases, these diseases or viruses coming from animals into human beings, that is an indicator of breaking down of our environment. So it doesn't matter where you do it. If I'm destroying my environment here, chances are something from here will go around the world. So wherever we are, whether you're in the Arctic, we're in the tropical Africa, let's look our biodiversity, because that is what will look after us. And it's demonstrated. The oxygen, the plant, the photosynthesis, both in the sea and the, that is what keeps life. Biodiversity is the order of life on Earth. If human beings and all life forms have to survive, we have to manage our biodiversity, both terrestrial, marine, and subsoil. We need to manage that.
Africa is the nexus of enterprise, and global business will tell you why it matters.
From the mega investment projects to multi-billion dollar mergers and acquisitions,
Africa today collects, just in terms of revenues from taxes alone, $545 billion a year. If you take 10% of that and you devote it to the energy sector, problem solved.
All this on Global Business, weekdays at this time on CGTN.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
A group of women entrepreneurs in the Democratic Republic of Congo have set up a company that will convert agricultural material into value-added products. The aim is to create employment and contribute to the country's economic development. The company owners met with other Congolese businesswomen at a conference in the capital, Kinshasa, to discuss ways of helping women generate income. CGTN's Chris Chamringa has more from Kinshasa.
Noda Luafa is a mother of nine who's been selling charcoal in Kinshasa for 19 years. Her husband died a year ago, leaving her the huge task of fending for her family. She has dreams of expanding her business, but lacks money to do so.
In the past, my business was doing very well. I used to sell two or three sacks a day, but it's now moving very slowly. I had plans of stocking more sacks, but there's little money in circulation. I just can't afford to expand.
Noda is one among millions of women who are struggling to support their families in the DRC. A group of prominent women entrepreneurs in the DRC have formed a company that will help small-scale business women make more money.
So we need to put them together, train them, so that we can create like big company, and this company is going to contribute to the economy, to produce jobs and all these things.
They will start off with a company called Tulime Pamoja that will produce maize flour. The owners intend to help women engaged in small-scale business to move away from fighting for survival to start making profits.
Up to now, we have small agriculture, you know, people with small piece of land. And this project comes with, let's invest together and make something big for everybody. I think this will be like the pilot that will push on other people to invest also in the same model.
The DRC is estimated to have 80 million hectares of arable land, but only 10% of it is currently being used. That's because conflicts in the east of the country have forced thousands of people to abandon their farms.
Women doing business face several challenges in the DRC. Some of the most serious ones include limited access to finance and disproportionate family responsibilities. The conflicts in the east of the country have made their situation worse, but the government has promised to help improve the business environment for women across the country. Chris Ochamringa, CGTN, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo.
The 10th China Flower Expo has opened its doors on Shanghai's suburban Chongming Island. Around 20,000 species of flowers will dazzle visitors, including many rare and exotic varieties. Businesses are also attending as they look to rake in a profit. Cheng Tong is there.
The Century Pavilion looks just like a butterfly. And it's one of the most popular spots at China's premier flower expo this year.
Inside the Century Pavilion, so refreshing. All types of seeds and plants are on display. It's just like your backyard garden.
The rare and exotic plants are attracting tourists in droves.
I just want to take a look. The plants are rare.
We aren't usually able to see plants like this. It's great.
The Century Pavilion covers a total area of 12,000 square meters.
In addition to the seeds on display inside, the outside garden also exhibits tropical plants rarely seen in Shanghai.
People want to come to the flower expo because they want to see the flowers, smell the scent, and relax. But these flowers are everywhere. So in addition to the ordinary flowers, we offer special plants that are rarely be seen here.
The flower expo is far more than a flower exhibition. As of the end of 2020, China's flower plantation area has reached more than 15,000 square kilometers. China is now the largest flower producer in the world, and that means huge business opportunities.
This year's Flower Expo also includes a flower trade fair. Producers show off their latest designs, hoping to attract more consumers and exhibition. Zhao Hai is witnessing better sales on indoor plants.
Not many people knew about our products in the past, but since last year we're seeing more and more orders and we're now hiring new staff to expand our business.
Some 400 companies from 19 provinces and cities will be showing their products until June. The organizer says Chinese consumers favor new species of flowers with strong aesthetics. In 2020, flower sales in China reached some $42 billion.
China's flower market has upgraded in recent years. New products have come out, and new things from overseas have also been introduced. People are accepting these high-quality products, relatively high prices.
The Flower Expo has attracted high numbers of tourists since opening. Some 20,000 tourists came for the opening on Friday. The event will remain open to the public until July. Chen Tong, CGTN, Shanghai.
Chinese agronomist and academician Yuan Longping, globally renowned for developing the first hybrid rice strains, died on Saturday at the age of 91. Thousands of people have visited the funeral parlor where his body is resting to pay their respects. Our reporter Sao Bing has more from Changsha.
It has been a very emotional morning this morning, as you can see that thousands of people have come to this Changsha Mingyangshan funeral home and to pay their condolences to our academician Yuan Longping, who has passed away at noon on Saturday at the age of 91. According to the staff here, many people came in as early as 5 o'clock and they kept voluntarily lining up to pay their tribute and say farewell to the academician. Yuan Longping is very famous, known for its hybrid rice. He started his studies in as early as 1970s. In a very popular ask and answer social media platform, Quora, there was once a question that was very popular asking how China can feed its 1.4 billion people. And there is no doubt that Yuan Longping's hybrid rice plays a very important part in that. Nowadays, his rice makes up about 60% of the total production in China. There are many young people, teenagers, and some pupils even came in with their chrysanthemums in hands to pay their tribute to Yuan Longping. And I can also find some like messages inside the flowers calling Yuan Longping grandfather Yuan and say that they will eat well and cherish food. As for those people who cannot come in person to pay their tribute, the staff told me that they have also set a mourning hall on the internet and people can send their condolences and pay their tribute on the internet.
Inhabited for over 700 years, Kenya's Lamu Town is considered by many as the cradle of Swahili civilization. But the World Heritage Site is now being threatened by pollution and a growing number of motorcycle taxis, locally known as Boda Bodas. CGTN's Daniel Arap Moy tells us more.
In this small island town of Lamu, a historic Swahili trading outpost, motorbikes maneuver through a crush of donkeys.
Lamu Mpunda. Punda ndo Lamu.
Lately, there has been an increase in the number of motorbikes. Residents here are not pleased about the two-wheelers congesting ancient narrow lanes.
Long time ago, we used it a donkey transportation. Yeah, to collect all things like a material of building houses, like food to supply for another town. But this boda-boda is a big terrible.
This is too much. It's everywhere. When you walk in the market everywhere, you find a motorbike somewhere. hey, you want to go where? Where you want to go? Which is no good. Lamu, we love a donkey. We love walking. This is the best. It's no good for motorbike for lamu.
Donkeys used for centuries to ferry chunks of washed coral to build Lamu's iconic Swahili homes are slowly phasing out.
Residents of this small island of Lamu fear that their delicate ecosystem, their livelihood, and their ancient way of life could soon be lost.
Mia Miji is a resident of Lamu who runs the restaurant business. Mia says the noise generated by motorcycle engines has driven away his customers.
It was very lovely here. You can sit here and see the view, have your drinks and relax and peace. No problem. But since the motorbike has arrived now, you can't even walk around. For me, I'm afraid to walk with my child on the street. I can't walk with my child on the street any minute because you don't know which side is for motorbike, which side is for people.
The youth who depend on these motorbikes for a living are defending their trade.
With the border, they are helping people. They are helping youth. It has created a lot of employment. All people, all youth who are under these robbery gangs that have entered the border, they have changed their life.
It's true, border borders have increased in number. But let's allow the youth to continue their work and earn a living.
The impact of overfishing in Lamu has left fewer employment options for the island's youth. But the increasing presence of motorbikes here is feared could soon erode the cultural richness of this historical town. UNESCO declared Lamu Town a World Heritage Site in 2013. Daniel Arap Moy, CGTN, Lamu, Kenya.
The greatest journeys. The greatest sights. The greatest adventures.
Here in Panathur, this weir allows the locals to walk on water.
We're far more than just TV news. We're your passport to the wonders of Africa.
To bring you stories of struggle, survival and hope.
So let's explore. CGTN, see the difference.
A South Africa entrepreneur is on a mission to provide millions of children in South Africa with shoes. Economic hardships mean many learners are left without basic necessities, including school shoes. The Barefoot Walk Challenge is an initiative run by Hope for Africa Foundation, which is trying to ensure children have what they need for school.
It's estimated 7 million African children go to school barefoot or without proper shoes. Many pupils in South Africa have never had a pair of their own, but Barefoot Walk Africa is trying hard to change this reality.
Every year for the last 5 years, Jabulani Tabeti has put his shoes away for 40 days to raise funds for school shoes for poor children in South Africa.
There are kids who cry when they don't have school shoes, so others they get heartbroken, they don't focus in school because they don't look the same. So we decided to sacrifice our 40 days without our shoes.
Tabeti himself had faced the embarrassment of not having new school shoes. He vowed not to rest until every child can go to school with the appropriate footwear.
When I was in Eastern Cape, the kids were walking barefoot there. So what I saw there, I cried for that day, the whole night, because I feel their pain. Now it's winter season. When they walk to school, and what do you feel? They feel cold. Some other kids, they drop out at school. So we need to balance those kind of things.
Close to 5,000 children have so far benefited from the program. These primary school children are the latest recipients.
Most of the children, they don't have parents. They live with their grandparents, so the children don't have shoes, and the grandparents come to our school and ask for assistance. Even with the food, they come to school and ask for the assistance. That's why we feel that we must find the donation to donate for this wilderness.
If I see a child walking with abnormal school shoe, I have to take care of that child because it takes a village to raise a child. So the initiative, it's promoting for us to say it takes a village to raise a child, and it's promoting to give back to the community and love and integrity most of the time.
youth initiative is growing across Africa, in Kenya, Botswana, Lesotho and Swaziland. In South Africa, Tabeti has roped in ambassadors, donors and friends to join the Barefoot Challenge. Julie Shara, CGTN, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Coming up in sports, we tell you the story of a boxer in Togo who has set up a center for the social reintegration of children and unemployed youth.
A total of 26 member states have now reported the occurrence of the B.1.1.7 variant in their countries. And a very similar number, 25, have reported the presence of the B.1.351 variant. Guinea-Bissau is the new addition, new added country for having reported this variant, that is the B.1.351 variant. Two additional member states, that is Botswana and Zambia, have now reported the B.1.617 variant, which is the variant that was originally reported or identified in India. And now that brings up to a total of 9 countries that have now reported the presence of that variant in Africa. And because the number is still small, I can read them. That includes Angola, Botswana, DRC, Kenya, Morocco, Nigeria, South Africa, Uganda, and Zambia. Again, before I transition from this variant mapping, I just want to say that the way this virus circulates and transmits suggests that it's a question of time before these variants will be spreading more extensively across the continent. And we can discuss that during the question and answer phase. So what are the trends we have seen in the last 1 week across the continent? So if we look at the epidemiological week 18 and compare that to the epidemiological week 19, which is this week, we notice that a total of 56,000 new cases have been reported to this. And this accounts for a 6% decrease from the previous week. In terms of death, a total of 1,800 new deaths have been reported across the continent, and that represents a 12% decrease in the number of new deaths across the continent. If we now look at the 4 weeks trends, that is the period between 19 April and 16 May, we notice the following: a 9% overall average decrease in new cases in Africa, with the following regional trends: 26% increase in Central Africa, 13% increase in Southern Africa, 11% decrease in North Africa, 14% decrease in West Africa, and 19% decrease in East Africa. In terms of new deaths over the last 4 weeks, we noticed that an average of 4% average decrease in deaths have occurred across the continent, with the following breakdown by the most populous countries: 11% average increase in Egypt, 8% average increase in South Africa, 13% average decrease in Ethiopia, 5% average decrease in Kenya, 19% average decrease in DRC, and 50% average decrease in Nigeria. In terms of testing, over 46 million tests have been conducted across the continent, and 696,000 new tests were conducted or reported in the week 19, that is between last week and this week. Unfortunately, this represents a 6% decrease in the number of tests. The overall positivity rate still stands at 10%, to be specific, 10.2%. Africa CDC continues to support member states to distribute 700 oxygen concentrators and accessories to 26 member states. Again, this is in line with the adapted strategy we announced last week following the meeting of May 8, which calls for a shift in our strategy to focus on enhanced prevention, enhanced monitoring, and enhanced treatment. And on the need that enhanced treatment, we really are pushing for countries to have adequate stocks of the oxygen concentrators. So I'm very...
For other provinces that have not yet completed, and probably when they complete all this, this number might change, and we'll have a result on that. But also, we've made a comparison between the gender, the female and male, and if you see, for Sierra Leone and Zimbabwe, you have more prevalence of the serosurveys among female compared to male, which is about 40% higher than among female compared to male. For Uganda, there's no significant difference between the female and male in terms of the positivity of this serology. And also, you also see, which is in contrary with Sierra Leone and Zimbabwe, for Zambia, you have more male presenting with higher sero prevalence compared to female. So for Malawi, They had tested about 1,020 individuals, and still the process is ongoing. We didn't present the data here because it's still ongoing. And among those 111 tested positive, which is almost equivalent to 10%, but again, we'll present their results when they finalize that and to have an official clearance from the country in terms of how many tested positive. So this is a slide that also presents some seroprevalence in Nigeria. And Nigeria also are doing several states, but we here will be presenting only data for four states that have already completed their data collection and they are also completed data analysis, of which if you look for the four states, the overall seropositivity is ranging from 8.8% to about 23.4%. And if you look on the graph on your left, you'll see that you have mostly, apart from the two, especially for the two states that have a higher prevalence, we have more females with a higher prevalence compared to males, while in Gombe and Nasarawa, you have more male positivity compared to females. So on your right-hand side, if you see that the graph, it really shows that we have more positivity in urban areas compared to rural areas. So that means most of people tested positive within the rural area, within the urban area when you compare to rural areas. And this could also be explained by the mobility and the complexity that is involved with the urban settings compared to rural settings. So as per age, if you look for age groups also, you see that you have most of people the age that has more higher positivity rate is the age between 18 to 64, and then the other one between 10 to 17. And you, the lower age, especially those less than 2 years, have been presented a very low positivity rate of this. So as a takeaway message, I would like to emphasize on four things. Number one, we have a very wide variation in terms of seroprevalence in these few countries that we've presented here. And that range from around 3% to almost about 23%, means about 23 out of every 100 individuals within this country, these places where the positivity is around 3% have previously or currently been exposed to the virus. So with this also, it takes us to the second point that we have still a significant proportion of African population that is remains susceptible to the virus that causes COVID-19. And this will require us to invest on mechanisms to regenerate critical evidence that will guide on response strategies, especially covering the susceptible population through prioritization of interventions, including the rollout of the vaccine that is ongoing. But also, this emphasizes also because of the higher population that is still susceptible that African government need to really commit on scaling up the COVID-19 vaccination to protect the population and reduce the risk of developing the COVID-19 variants, especially the new variants that are circulating, as well as emphasize on ensuring that we use sero survey data to serve as a baseline to measure effectiveness of vaccine and rollout and to be able to see if all these interventions are very effective and to be able to measure at the end what we've achieved with these different interventions. Over to you, Madam Nguyen, for the next.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Justin, for that presentation.
Now, colleagues, we've come to the section where we take your questions so that Dr. John, Dr. Maeda, and those country representatives can respond to them live on this platform. As we indicated at the beginning, please do indicate who your question is directed to when you pose your question. And also for colleagues joining us online, please remember that this is an event for media. It is a press briefing, so kindly allow only the media members to put forward their questions. And in doing so, they should indicate their names and the agencies that they are representing. Okay, we move straight into our question and answer section. And the first question that we have, let me just locate it. It is coming from Sophie Mukwena, who is with SABC. And Sophie is the news foreign editor. So she says, there are reports that people who have been vaccinated actually test positive for COVID-19. Can you share information on your observations and what could be the reasons for such cases? I think this one is for you, Dr. John.
Thank you, Sophie. And let me repeat what I've said and what we all know, that vaccines do not prevent from anyone from being infected. They prevent from you from developing the severe diseases and death. So that is why we continue to urge that even if people are vaccinated, you should continue to wear your mask. And if you look at those people that have been infected and actually turn out to be PCR positive, that is positive by the nuclear molecular test, they likely were not sick. And even though the literature have also shown that some people actually get sick, but again, you don't get the deaths do not occur from that. I think that's a good thing. So the vaccine do not provide absolute protection from infection, okay, but do protect you from developing disease and subsequently death. And we continue to monitor that on the continent, and we, Africa CDC, will be establishing with other member states a surveillance program to track and monitor those who have received vaccines and those who subsequently get infected, what you call vaccination breakthroughs.
Thank you very much. We have three questions coming from Yidnak Lema, but I'm going to take two in the question in the interest of time. So Yidnak says, my name is Yidnak Lema, and I'm the journalist for the Associated Press, as well as a freelancer for CGTN. Then he says, I'd like to ask Dr. John Kengasong the following questions. In your opinion...
Prepare countries so that they can receive these vaccines and use them quickly. And listen, we are at war with this virus, and anything that you can use quickly, we better do. I mean, and what our colleague from Malawi said is very important, that in excess of 85% of their vaccines were used. Okay, that is very, very positive news. And again, what we continue to maintain and insist is that the Serum Institute had given a certification that shelf life could be extended to the 13th of July. So, but we should look at a bigger picture, because vaccines are only now beginning to be rolled out on the continent. And the issues of whether countries use vaccines quickly will come up over and over. I mean, that this is not just going to be the first time. The doses that were shipped out, they were very early doses to actually say test the waters. And bigger doses will come in, but the key thing here is to focus on what Malawi did is within about 2 weeks or so, they were able to use up about 85% of the vaccines. That is very, very good news. The other thing we should be focusing on is preparing countries in such a way that they just replicate what Rwanda did. So within a week or so, Rwanda was able to use all its 290,000 doses of vaccines. I mean, that speaks to the reflexes that we should have in times of this pandemic. This is not an immunization against polio or cholera or measles, that we can take time to do it. It has to be at speed and it has to be at scale, which means every member state must be prepared, such that if they say you get vaccines today, you should be able to mobilize and get yourself into full swing and start using the vaccines, so that we don't get into arguments of who delivered the vaccines, who didn't use the vaccines, and whatever. I think it doesn't reflect the spirit of the urgency that we are in now. And if countries, again, this is my general advice, not to the Malawi situation, if any country receive vaccines and they find themselves in a position that they anticipate they cannot use it, they make a call to whoever donated early so that they can redistribute. DRC did just that a few weeks ago, and their vaccines were taken out of that country and redistributed. So I think we are in a situation where the vaccine market is extremely, extremely limited. The virus is raging, and we should just use all the tools in our disposition when they're available to continue to fight this the pandemic.
Thank you for that. We have a question from Bert Menzing from the ZDF German TV based in Nairobi. And so Bert says, is there any news about how and when member states will receive more doses of vaccines? And he's asking this in the context of some countries having already used up their available allocations.
So, as I've said this week, and last week, and the previous week, those doses that were distributed extensively across the continent came from the COVAX facility. And I'm sure you do, all of you on this platform do briefings with the COVAX facility in Geneva. It's really, they are better placed to address that question with respect to when countries can expect additional doses there. I can only speak authoritatively with respect to the vaccines from the AVAC mechanism, which is the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team. And just repeat what I've said many times, that vaccines from that facility will begin to be distributed beginning the first week of the third quarter. And so we are basically about 2 months from that, when those vaccines from the Johnson & Johnson will begin to be distributed. And we are preparing, working very hard to make sure that that is delivered. And with some luck, some early doses may be available, but not in large amounts. The vaccine situation is extremely challenging for us as a continent. We remain hopeful also that the positive signals that we are hearing from countries that that had acquired large amounts of vaccines are ready to begin to redistribute. I think I read that the United States is ready to redistribute about 60 to 80 million doses of vaccines. France has also committed to redistributing some, and we just hope that that can be done quickly so that we do not run into a gap between now and August when our doses from Johnson & Johnson will begin to kick in.
Thank you for that. Let's go live and invite Henry. And Henry is a freelancer with the Washington Post. Good morning, Henry. Hello, Henry. All right, it looks like we're having problems connecting with Henry. Let's move on to Paul Adepoju. Good morning, Paul.
Hello, good morning. Can
morning,
you hear me?
Please. Yes, we can hear you. You are from The Lancet. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, thank you very much. Dr. John, you said the strain that was first identified in India will eventually spread across Africa. Why is this so, and what are the peculiar implications of this prediction? And earlier today, the WHO launched the One Health panel. How is Africa CDC working towards breaking the easy crossover of zoonotic infections to humans in a number of African countries? And for the Nigerian representative, I would like to ask, when was the data gathering in Nigeria done, and what influenced the study site selection, considering several epicenters of the COVID-19 pandemic in Nigeria were not included? Thank you very much.
Hello, Paul. Can I just
Hello?
ask?
Yes, Paul, can I just ask you to repeat that last question so we can start with that and give it to the representative of Nigeria who's online?
Okay, thank you. So I asked that when was the data gathering in Nigeria done and what influenced the seroprevalence study site selection, considering several epicenters of the COVID-19 pandemic in Nigeria were not included?
Thank you. Can we go over to Professor Egbumbo from Nigeria?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks, Paul, for that question. The survey in Nigeria ran in Lagos between September 21st and October 1st, and in the other states between September 27th and October 27th. We have done the survey completely in four states, in Lagos, in Enugu, in Gombe, in Nasarawa states. But in selecting the states, we sought to get at least one state in every geopolitical zone. In terms of our surveillance data, we also tried to balance states with relatively high reporting of prevalence and as well as those with lower rates of reporting. We feel the current spread is reasonable, but are quickly making inroads in having surveys in additional states. We have concluded data collection in Sokoto in the Northwest, and we are preparing for data collection in South-South states of Delta, in the central states of FCT, and in Kano states. So indeed, we think that gradually would have had a surfeit of states covered through the survey. Again, thanks for the question. Over.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Prof. Maybe at this point, let me also give an opportunity to the other country representatives to speak to us a little bit about their participation in this seroprevalence survey. Let me start with Dr. Mohamed Bello Barry, the representative of Sierra Leone. Dr. Barry, in 2 minutes, please give us the main highlight points that you want people to take away from this press briefing today.
Which we randomized, we took the statistics Sierra Leone enumeration area that they used to conduct the DHS surveys, and we randomized those enumeration areas. We selected 120 of the enumeration areas. Then also within each enumeration areas, we randomized have 10 households, and in each household, we surveyed 1 to 2 people in the household, and we followed the age strata that was given, and then did both the serosurveillance and did some interviews in terms of exposure, symptoms, and other things. So basically, that's what we did, and it's a representative of the whole country. Because again, Sierra Leone is a small country compared to Nigeria and other countries, but like. And actually, with this kind of survey and sampling, we were able to sample each district in the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Barry. Can we have Dr. Henry Kyobe Bosa, the representative from the Republic of Uganda? In 2 minutes, please, Doctor, can you tell us your participation in this survey?
Thank you so much, Chair, and thanks so much, Dr. John. Our methodology largely mimics what was done in Sierra Leone, but I will specifically go on to the findings, where from the response data we see that here in Uganda, the disease, COVID, is predominantly a disease of the male, contributing up to 67% amongst the reported cases. But what we see here in the survey, what we got in the survey, that the findings between male and female are near even, around 20%, which is strange. Now we need to go back and find out exactly what really this means and where this comes from. But of course, the other thing is that with 20% of prevalence in Uganda, we see that the virus penetrated much deeper than actually we previously knew. And this speaks to the importance of this kind of study. And the fact that the methodology was quite representative, close to and similar to what our colleagues in Sierra Leone did, where we used the enumeration areas that are used in the national census, and we randomly selected 215 enumeration areas. And in each enumeration area, we were sampling 24 households, and in each household getting between 1 to 5 individuals of different age groups, and making sure that we do have both gender represented. Of course, noticing that our population pyramid is much skewed, that fewer and fewer older people above 60, we took anyone that we found in households. And as you see that we have, of course, we don't have complete data here displayed. And that gave us a very good picture and understanding on where we are. There were no big surprises. Of course, much of the data, as I said, is presented. Not so much surprises about the urban and rural distribution, where obviously urban distribution is much higher than the rural settings. And also, here briefly again, that this survey, we did a data collection between the 5th to 13th March, just before, and they were racing against time to make sure that we do have findings before we roll out the vaccination. And the other things, again, that were found, much of that data may not have been presented yet here, is that we saw nearly all age groups are affected.
Dr. Bosa, I will have to just jump in there and ask you please to, if you can make that presentation available to us at the end of the briefing, so that everyone can benefit from it. We are running a bit short of time, so I want to move on and invite Professor Victor Mukonka, the Republic of Zambia, for your 2 minutes, just giving us the main highlights of your participation in that survey. Professor Mukonka? All right, while we are preparing to hear from Professor Mukonka, let us move on to Dr. Wenceslas Nyamayaro.
Thank you, results were shown the low prevalence, which means that the country might be in danger if don't have a herd immunity at the moment. But as we stand now, we are doing a lot of vaccination, and we have sent quite a number. Out of the 800,000, we have vaccinated 600,000, the vaccines which we get.
Eswatini has engaged with Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson. It's a very good move and very encouraging move. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.